Do you want more energy, better sleep, and better health? Who wouldn't? Get a free Scalar Light no obligation 15-day trial at scalarlight.com.
Everyone, and welcome to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio,
your feel-good radio. On today's topic, we're talking about food forests. A widely used and sometimes undermined, an agroforestry system that has, although not been used so much today, has often been the basis of how we managed to live off berries and nuts throughout our history as humans on this planet. It is said that some of the Amazon, or a large part of the Amazon, has actually been shaped by food forestry. The oldest food forest was found in Morocco, and it was actually discovered by Geoff Lawson, who, on his travels across Morocco, stumbled across a village in the Atlas Mountains and noticed that the villagers were still getting their food from this forest, which was dated back to the Neolithic times. And this really just goes to show how this system has really been neglected but also resurrected, because now we're starting to realise the value and the importance of this system. Scientists are discovering that trees are planted next to or in certain formations with each other that has become evidence of the way food forestry has been used throughout our ancestry. Food forests are a low-maintenance, sustainable, plant-based food production and agroforestry system based on woodland ecosystems. They work by incorporating fruit, nut trees, shrubs, herbs, vines, and perennial vegetables, which have yields directly useful to humans. So basically, it's creating an ecosystem like that of which you'd find in a forest. It's all about companion planting. So this means intermixing to grow successions and layers to build up a woodland habitat. So this is a very prehistoric method of securing food in very tropical areas. This kind of term was coined in the 80s as forest gardening, and then it was taken to the West. And so far, it has been used in quite small amounts in pockets of communities. So when we talk about food forests being prehistoric, they go back as far as the hunter-gatherers. They are also an incredibly global agroforestry system. They have been used and given various names across the world, such as home gardens in Kerala, in South India, Nepal, Zambia, Zimbabwe and Tanzania. They're called Kandyan forests in Sri Lanka, Huertos Familiares, or family orchards in Mexico. And they have shown a significant source of income and food security for people in local populations. So I'm going to stop talking because we have today on the show Sean Dixon, who is the founder of Contour Lines, a not-for-profit organisation which is tackling erosion control in Guatemala using agroforestry systems. Because Guatemala has such high rainfall and have relied heavily on slash-and-burn agriculture, soil erosion, especially in mountainous areas, have become a real issue for these communities. Sean was travelling around Guatemala doing these various projects And he landed in a community where he really felt there was a real need and a real hunger for a change in the way that they do things in their agriculture.
So, hello, I'm Sean Dixon Sullivan. I'm from New Jersey, USA, but I live here in Guatemala the past 3 years. Yeah, a little bit about my story and like how I ended up here. I was traveling, volunteering through Woof Workaway. I was doing that for a couple of years prior. The final farm, the one that brought me to Guatemala, actually was number 35 out of all the places I worked over the years. So I ended up here on a farm. I ended up staying on as manager. And yeah, I've been here ever since. So from during my time at that farm, I also founded, along with a friend of mine in the U.S., a nonprofit called Contour Lions Corps. And in beginning of 2019, we started our first pilot site apart from that farm. And then in every 6 months, every planting season since then, we've been taking those methods into rural communities around the living scenario. And every planting season, it's been...
So I'm aware that there's many issues in Guatemala with monoculture farming and failure of crops due to drought and issues with the soil fertility due to slash and burn. So in your time whilst you were woofing, is this something that you witnessed firsthand?
Yeah, definitely. So like I said, I started off on a private farm. It was a bamboo farm we were planting. Mm-hmm. But right on the edges of those farms, there were villages. And throughout that municipality alone, the municipality of Livingston, there's 35 of these villages. And I could say like 99% of their land they use for slash and burn corn. A few guys have cows, but it's mostly slash and burn corn. For various reasons, that's really all they do. And there's, of course, the ecological problems with that. The land is very steep and the rainfall is very high. In metric system, it's 4,400 millimeters of rain per year, which is like four times of most temperate zones. So with that amount of rain hitting the ground, plus we're in very steep terrain, so the potential for soil erosion is very high. So basically when they slash and burn a parcel, the biomass from that cutting of that vegetation decomposes very quickly because of the climate. And that thin layer of topsoil is enough for that season of corn. Mm. By the end of that season, even that topsoil is washed away. So it's just rock. And so they have to leave the land fallow for another year, sometimes 2 years, so that enough biomass grows to get enough little bit of topsoil to grow more corn. So the ecological effects of that are horrible. And it's corn monoculture.
Yeah.
And they also use chemical herbicide as well. So the land's pretty degraded. The economic effects of that, the price of corn is so low that the amount of work they put into that is, if you factored in labor, like their own labor to do that work, which they don't factor in because there's no jobs really in the region, but they would be selling corn at a loss. So just a few numbers. They measure land by a manzana, which is about 1.5 acres or about 0.7 hectares. So one manzana of corn takes about 6 months, the growing season, from clearing to letting it dry, then burning it, then planting the corn, letting the corn grow, and then leaving the corn to dry on the stalks before harvesting. So 6 months of labor on about 1.5 acres, they can harvest about 10 quintales of corn, which is 1,000 pounds of corn. So they sell that. If they sell it all, there would be about $130.
And exactly. I'm just aware that as someone sat here in my house in the UK, it's kind of hard for me to judge that, because it's so easy to say, well, they shouldn't be cutting the rainforest, but that's their livelihood. Mm-hmm. That's how they have to live. From hearing your experiences with it, it doesn't seem to serve the community to be doing monoculture farming. So for some people, it seems like the only solution. And for those of you listening right now, I interviewed Sean a couple of, well, it's like a year ago now, And I also interviewed some of the people that you were working with in the communities. And I know there was Juan, who was like 23-year-old farmer. And this is in the article for those of you who want to read it. But he said to me that a lot of people would have left if it wasn't for your project because of what you were talking about it not being worth the work, and that he would have left if it wasn't for Contour Lines. So it's clear that you're having a positive impact on the community as well. So that was just like a really nice thing to hear. And also there was a woman called Flory, who is a female farmer. And she was saying as well that she's happy that the village is now not just living off corn because fertilizer is so expensive. So these are all really amazing things that have come out of the mouths of people that you're working with. How was it that you were able to gain the trust from these people to change the whole system of their livelihood to adopt this new way of farming, forest gardening?
So the first thing I'd say to anyone interested in doing this is read the book, 2 Ears of Corn by Roland Bunch. That's like the Bible of this type of work. It's a survey of all the agricultural nonprofits over the past 30 years and their successes and failures. And I wish I read it sooner. I read it like maybe like a year and a half into this work. And every sentence of that book was like, ah, damn, I wish I did that. Or like, yes, I did that. All right. But it's great. So anyone I meet here doing this that like makes an excuse why they're not going to read it, like I can't even look at them, like seriously, because it's a must read. I have a local partner, a nonprofit that's run by local guys. They've been here for years. They know all the communities. And I really go to them a lot when, for example, if we have a new round of planting, like more projects to offer, I go to them. I'm like, all right, which communities do you recommend? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you recommend apply? And the model we developed, like how to work with communities and how to kind of enforce compliance and maintenance of the trees, that whole strategy was developed with them. A lot of that came from them. It's called Aprosarstun, like Aprovechar Sarstun, which is the Sarstun River and all the villages in that region.
Nice.
So having them, and it also, maybe I'll explain later, the model that we use, the expansion model, also the engagement model with communities. But what we do is we go, I'll go with one of those guys to each new community when we're ready to start working in a new community. Mm. And they'll introduce me. So that really helps a lot. Also, there's, as far as gaining trust, also helps to know how to swing a machete and to do that when you're working on the site with people.
To actually know how to do it on the ground before telling them how to do that.
From the perspective of the new villages, for them to see other locals doing the same work and to be so passionate about it, that really helps convince people. And that's been a huge part of the success as well. Mm. So thanks to those two guys.
In the article that I last interviewed you for, I also interviewed Mike Hans, who runs the Inga Foundation. And he had an amazing story about his work in Honduras. And he was saying that what he did was create a pilot project where villagers could just see what was happening with the food forests in comparison to its neighboring. He also did the slash and burn, and he tried the food forest. And I think it was part of his own experiment to see how they both worked. And the food forest was so successful that people would naturally adopt that method over the slash and burn without even being asked or introduced to the method, because farmers could just see that these farmers who were doing food forests were so successful, and also withstanding floods and storms and all sorts of weather crazy patterns. So yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Do you see that as well? People just naturally, neighbors just naturally adopting food forests into their garden?
Yeah, that's the ideal way to do this work, is that and that really shows that it's that successful. We actually are using Mike Hans's his model as well, the Inga alley cropping, planting rows of Inga edulis. Mm. And the seed, that the exact seed we were using comes from him, brought by Apersursun, like through them about 8 years ago.
Oh, nice.
And now we're self-sufficient in that variety, which he has been spreading.
It's amazing how his seeds have been spreading like around. I know that he was working with another project in Africa who exchanged beekeeping lessons for his seeds as well. So, yeah.
Cool. Well, to answer your question about the, so we also have a pilot site, which is 2 years along now. And you could really see the different, I mean, people really understand these methods after seeing them. Because, like, for example, if like a log is laying on the ground on contour, like perpendicular to slope, it's like quite obvious that all this eroding soil accumulates behind it versus a hillside where there's no soil. You know, after clearing a slash and burning a hill, they can see all the sediment accumulating in the river below. So it's quite well, it's understood, these things. It doesn't take convincing. The thing that it takes is the incentive, I guess you could call it, or just the funding to start for these food forests. We're planting fruit trees, like grafted fruit trees, which takes a lot of time, or in our case, money. We buy them from a local nursery, which people just don't have. So so for these projects growing, it's really just been in the form of other villages seeing the work or hearing about it, and then just requesting trees. Like, I get people coming every day, like, you know, could you come to our village? Like, we're in this village out there, bring trees, please. And so that's how it's been. And we're also getting now to the point where people are also starting their own nurseries to grow their own trees, so that they're not, because we don't want these projects to be dependent on contour lines. You know, like, locals need to take the initiative. We're going to phase ourselves out eventually. So this has to be a locally run thing. And so for that, it has to be tree nurseries in this case.
Right. And it's pretty remarkable how many, because you're crowdfunding a lot of these projects, right? So do you know how many trees have been planted since the crowdfunding began?
Yeah, about the funding, we started at the first three fruit forest sites we planted in Tatin Village. That's the first village we started in.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did that, just a crowdfunding campaign, mostly messaging my friends and family, bothering them for money. $3,000. And then with the planting of that round, those three sites, Don Carlos being one of them, those guys were the first three trainees on the pilot site that became the benefactors of the first three food forests. So filming that, I made a video, then relaunched the crowdfunding campaign up to like 9,000 to plant six more. Then during that time, we also reduced our costs significantly. That's when I read, that's thanks to reading 2 years of corn and then meeting and planning with Apersursun. So we basically removed labor costs from the equation. And so we brought the budget way down, and then we were able to fund the next 12 sites with only 6,000 more, crowdfunding up to $16,000.
That's a lot of trees.
Before I continue on with the interview, I want to take you all to Livingston, to Guatemala, and share some of the community's voices with you. I'm going to translate because it's in Spanish, but what they say is pretty amazing, so I want you to hear it from the community themselves.
A mí me gustan las frutas que están sembrando porque de eso vamos a vivir, vamos a cosechar y lo vamos a vender, sí, para nuestros hijos.
I like the fruit trees we are planting because from this we will live and we will harvest. We will sell for our children.
Estamos sintiendo, estamos viendo otro estilo de siembra y este va a beneficiar bastante.
We are feeling, we are seeing a new style of planting, and this will benefit us greatly.
Solo cosechamos una sola vez en el mismo terreno.
In the past years, we would only harvest once on the same land. We wanted to plant again, but the fertility no longer supported the crops because it was burnt. Because we'd clear for corn and then we'd lose the fertility.
So like 42 kilometers of erosion control contour lines right now throughout Livingston. And fruit trees planted, so almost 7,000 fruit trees, 41,000 legume trees, and 41,000 annuals. So total plants, we have almost 100,000 plants planted through our projects with $36,000. That's been our total budget through our crowdfunding campaigns, through ecosystem restoration camps, crowdfunding campaign. And then recently we've been getting support from John Rulak, who's been supporting this expansion into, we're now working in 12 villages to these partners.
It's amazing because it seems like so many people really want to like give their money or fund this kind of project on the ground.
Listen to us.
Yeah, and it's amazing that from that single pilot plot, it's just grown. And what's the community like? How have they responded to this? It must be quite like a special thing for them.
Yeah, well, like Tatin, for example, they have about 1,000 hectares. Like these communities, it's actually a very rare situation here around Livingston where these local indigenous people own all this land through like some laws that were included in the peace accords after the Civil War. People living on land, which historically has been like, you know, laborers working for big landowners, they can, through a legal process, they can gain the right to that land. And actually around Livingston, they came in during the Civil War, like since the 60s, 70s, to these lands, which were used to be owned by large landowners, but were mostly abandoned. Because snakes killed most of the cows here. They tried just filling the land with cows for profit. Just part of the story. So they came fleeing they came from the highlands. So they're not, these communities aren't traditionally from here. They're Kekchi, which come from Koban, like farther in the highland. But they came here just basically, I've heard some stories, it's pretty cool, that they would just get together in a group and just go out into the jungle and just find a place where people weren't yet. And just set up a community. And now, in recent years, very recent years, they're starting to get legal titles to those lands. So they have a lot of land as, you know, like poor indigenous people with land. I think that's very rare in the world, in the country. So there's a lot of potential here. So anyway, so in Tatin, they have about 1,000 hectares. About half is in forest reserve through the like the government forestry agency pays like incentive money. To keep that, and then the other half of that is in slash and burn corn in rotation. Each, there's about 100 families. Each family has about 5 hectares that they rotate through. So right now in Tatin we have 42 project sites. But yeah, just seeing the enthusiasm and people wanting to plant more trees is very encouraging.
But I guess they've gone through their own struggle and they're still going through their own struggles despite.
Yeah. Like what you said earlier about, like, we can't really judge, because there are reasons why the slash and burn, it is very effective, and it, like, corn is sacred to Mayan people, and they eat it every meal, tortillas. I'm starting to become an addict to tortillas myself.
Oh, no, I was in Guatemala. I was totally there with them and the corn. Yeah. And it's so nutritious as well. It really is.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So we're not, we try to be careful. We're not saying that we're going to replace corn.
Yeah.
Corn is like very important here, and it's always going to be a part of the agriculture and the diet, of course.
Of course.
But so these food forests are supplemental to the corn, and they also are hopefully, ideally reduce the need to to grow excess corn for sale for income. Like that part of the equation can be replaced with more productive and more ecological food force.
Sure.
The corn is so prevalent is because that's really all that they can afford to plant. The agriculture takes investment. And like I said, the fruit trees, they're expensive. Like you have to buy them. They're grafted. They've been worked on in the nursery for 6 months or longer. So and people here just don't have that money. It's like compared to corn, where you just take like just a little bit of the seed from the previous harvest, like a pound, and you can plant another hectare.
Right.
And that's really just all people have done. And that's all they know is planting corn.
Yeah. Have you heard of the Three Sisters corn planting method?
Yeah, definitely. To have the corn and the beans growing up it and the squash on the ground.
Yeah.
Like actually, the corn isn't that well suited to this climate because of the rain and the humidity.
Yeah.
They have to time the planting so that the harvest comes in the dry season or else it'll rot.
Right.
But anyway, for that reason, they don't. And they also have to space the corn very far apart in this climate, so that air can pass and it doesn't rot. That's another reason that is not that productive.
Right.
So also they can't have other crops like beans and squash in there.
That's part of a different culture. I think that's a Native American planting method where they grow together. So I guess, like you say, that won't work in that climate. But then again, I know that slash and burn has its place for some communities, and that's how they survive. So, yeah it's I'm not judging it, basically. Yeah. But
it does work, and but the thing is, you have to have enough land to let the so after you harvest, you have to let it go fallow and regrow before it, and then like move on to the next land, and then come back like a rotation. Mm. But the problem is if there's just not enough land and too many people, it doesn't work. But if there is enough land, there are not too many people, it is actually not that bad for the ecosystem, especially if there's plenty of old growth forest around, to have land that's being put back into early ecological succession. That actually helps biodiversity. The problem is that it's just done on too large of a scale and too short a rotation with too many people. With chemicals.
And am I right in believing that the monoculture kind of system was mainly brought from Western farmers who decided that because I've heard that actually a lot of the rainforest has been shaped by food forestry, and that has always been a part of indigenous farming method. So I guess in a way it's kind of reviving what was lost by colonizers coming and saying, actually, no, this needs to be done this way. I guess there's an element of that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's another book I recommend. It's called The Maya Forest Garden, which is a historical, archaeological, and anthropological study of the Mayan agriculture. And yeah, it was food forest. They did some slash and burn rotation. They would leave certain trees like for food that they selected. Mm. So over time, yeah, like you said, the whole entire rainforest would be shaped by humans, species selected by humans. But when the Europeans came, they saw that as disorderly. They couldn't like tax it and export it as well. So they cut it all down. And yeah, that's actually the monocultures that these specific communities are planting with these corn seeds and with herbicides and sometimes fertilizer. That's a very recent development since like the 1950s. Before that, it was more biodiverse.
Yeah. And what would you say, I mean, since you started the project, your biggest challenge has been so far?
Like what has been lacking the most is the funding. And that's the thing that I enjoy doing the least. And I found myself spending the most time doing to find funds, and that's been like the greatest bottleneck. Like we have Yeah, like I said, 36 communities that all want to plant. They all have the land, the manpower, the woman power. Mm. The seeds are ready in the nursery. It's just the funds is the main thing that's lacking. So that's been the greatest challenge. And I don't like doing that because, like, I'm a farmer. I like to plant trees. But I'm, you know, on the internet making Facebook posts instead. I don't like it. Or doing interviews.
Yeah. So I guess that brings me on to how listeners can help Contour Lands to grow. Do you have any current crowdfunders or projects that you would like to raise awareness to?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the easiest thing that you could do is just give a little money. And we have our crowdfunder, the same one that started the first food forests. It's going on its fourth round now with the same crowdfunder. We've like expanded it, updated it. It's on the fourth round. And now the theme going into 2021 is the advanced stages of this regenerative transition of these communities, which has a few themes. Like one, the one we're funding first is the annuals project. It's also the women's project because women are planting these annuals specifically. Mm. So that, the point of that is to put these communities into self-sufficiency for these seeds, mostly plátano or plantain in English, pineapple and cassava. So the crowdfunding campaign is going to fund these next themes over the next few months. So if anyone could give, that'd be great. Also, we also need, because it's really like just me here, as well as my girlfriend who does the building design, she's an architect, and also helping with the products. But apart from that, it's really just there's nobody else, and the locals, of course. So there are roles that I really need that could be very useful, like any type of scientists that could do a study, anything from the economics, like the anthropology in the communities, to soil scientists to study the effects of the soil with our agricultural work. So we need scientists, people to study. So anyone who wants to come do that, you're welcome to come. Also, anyone who's down to do social media, grant writing, fundraising, we could use your help as well. Or just tourists who want to come and help leave some money for the communities, you're all welcome. And that'd be a big help.
Do you take volunteers who might not have much experience in the field?
Yeah, we'll take volunteers who have a little money. Experience doesn't matter. If they pay for a homestay in a community,
yeah,
and helps the local family.
Any listeners who might have been planning a trip to South Central America, even, that sounds like a good opportunity to get out there and get planting, connecting with communities. Guatemala is an amazing country. I truly, truly love it. And I also hope to return myself someday.
Yeah, I hope you do. Come check out the project.
I will for sure. It will be my first stop. Cool. Thank you so much, Sean, for joining us today on the Environmental and Conservation Show. It's been great to hear you and your story and hear about Contour Lines. And I will link everyone to any of the books that you've recommended at the bottom, or also any crowdfunding links as well, so people can go ahead and research more about what you do and potentially give.
Cool. Yeah, thank you, Yasmin. It's been a pleasure.
For those of you who are interested in creating your own food forest at home, I'm going to give you a breakdown of what exactly it is and how it's formed and how you can create one yourself at home in your back garden. And yes, you don't need to be in Guatemala or in a tropical country to do one. So it's a 7-layer system. You have the canopy layer, and this consists of original maturing fruit trees. And then you have the lower tree layer, and this is of small nut or fruit trees on dwarfing rootstocks. Third, you have the shrub layer of fruit bushes such as currants and berries. And then we're going lower into the herbaceous layer of perennial vegetables and herbs. And then you have the physosphere. And this is the underground dimension of plants grown for their roots and tubers, so like ginger and turmeric. And then you have the ground cover layer of edible plants that spread horizontally. And finally, in the seventh layer, you have the vertical layer of vines and climbers. So that's just a kind of Western idea of how we would grow a food forest here. And of course, that's going to change depending on where and what climate. That is a basic structure of a food forest. My first piece of guidance is to first observe. Observe, explore, analyze, and look at what grows in your local forests. And this will give you an idea about what kind of environment you're working with and what kind of herbs, plants, trees you want to introduce into your own space. And then going from the design layer that I've just given you, think about your own design. It might help to just draw some taller trees, lower shrubs, vine area, herbs, and then ground and root layer, and kind of just label what kind of plants you think might work together. And this is a really fun part, so I'd really, really recommend just having fun, but also thinking quite carefully about what makes companion plants and what would grow well together. A book that I'd recommend, especially for the design, is Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemenway. There are different types of food forests. You might choose to go for a savanna type system, more of an alley cropping system. You could go for an orchid system, and this is more kind of like a woodlandy spaced area. But yeah, I'll let you look into that. Just make sure that you list all of the plants that you wish to grow and think very carefully about the ecological functions needed throughout the garden for such food production. And then you want to prepare your site. And this could mean adapting it if necessary, clearing any unwanted vegetation, leaving whatever you find useful as well, and being careful not to remove everything. You can also use any available biomass for mulch, compost, wood chips, firewood, mushroom inoculation is also a thing. And then you just need to source your plants and start planting. And it really is as simple as that. So the best and the most beautiful thing about this is once it's all set up and growing, it will just need light looking after, but it won't be anything too crazy. You leave it to grow, the more things will start working together. And just remember to do this in stages. So, and some books that I'm going to recommend for a really practical breakdown, How to Make a Forest Garden by Patrick Whitefield. There's also Integrated Forest Gardening, The Complete Guide to Polycultures and Plant Yields in Permaculture System by Bryce Ruddock. And then just as a final one that I've already mentioned, I've heard this is a really good book. It's called Gaia's Garden, A Guide to Home-Scale Permaculture by Toby Hemenway. So I hope that helps. And because this podcast has been so much listening, I want to offer you the next few minutes just to maybe write down anything, any inspiration you've had, to journal, draw, meditate on what we've been talking about throughout this podcast. And I really hope you enjoyed, and thank you for listening. You've been listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. I do just want to mention as well that we're always interested in hearing what you have to say about nature connection, what that means to you. We do Voices of the People podcast, and that means just getting all voices on from the public to talk about what that means to them. So please do get involved. If you know anyone who works very closely in the kind of areas that we're talking about in environment and conservation, or just people that are very into this kind of stuff and you think would like to be interviewed on the show, please let me know. You can follow me on Instagram. It's at Yasmin Anta. That's Yasmin A-N-T-A. And once again, thanks for listening. And I really am going to stop talking now and let you have your journaling quiet, listening to nature sounds. So enjoy, and thank you so much again. You have been listening to the Environment and Conservation Show on UK Health Radio. Hope you liked the show. If so, please do like, share, and send any feedback. Thanks for listening.